Good evening, everyone. I'm Ann Donderman, director of the Fisher Library, and I'm pleased to welcome you to the final lecture in the Friends of Fisher 2014-2015 season, the George Cadell Memorial Lecture on the History of the Book. The lecture, known until last year as the Griffin, was initiated and funded by George Cadell and was the first of our endowed Friends of Fisher lectures. His support has made it possible for us to continue the series, now renamed in his honor. This year marks the 21st lecture, and the series has included such distinguished figures in the world of book history as Leslie Morris, Mark Purcell, Miriam Foote, and Nicholas Pickwood on a great variety of topics. The subject of tonight's talk, Books as History, is one that hits home with all of us who have the pleasure and privilege of working intimately with the Fisher book and manuscript collections. Each book, no matter how ordinary it may at first appear, has a story to tell, apart from its content, if we pay attention to its physical characteristics. Whether we are cataloging a 12th century gradual, such as the one I showed you at the Katz lecture earlier this month, which has a history dating back many hundreds of years, or General James Wolfe's copy of Gray's Elegy, given to him by his fiancée, which he had with him in Quebec, or a 19th century cookbook, once in the library of the Moody Chamberlain Dunn family. The physical book is the center of a network of writers, printers, publishers, binders, booksellers, owners, and readers, and can elucidate aspects of any or all of those communities. Even a book as intensively studied as Shakespeare's First Folio can divulge secrets if it is closely examined, as we are doing now with our copy of the First Folio in preparation for an exhibition marking Shakespeare's death in 2016. Our speaker tonight, David Pearson, has lectured and published extensively on many aspects of book history and has a particular interest in provenance, on the ways that books have been owned, used, and bound. His books include the influential Provenance Research in Book History, first published in 1994, English Bookbinding Styles, 2005, and Books as History, 2008. He is currently Director of Culture, Heritage, and Libraries for the City of London Corporation and has previously worked in a range of important libraries and collections, including the British Library, the National Art Library, the Wellcome Library, and the University of London Library. This is his first visit to Toronto, although many of you know him and his work very well. We are happy to have him here tonight to deliver a talk entitled Books as History, Changing Values in the Digital Age. Please welcome David Pearson.
Thank you. Thank you very much for those kind words. You haven't heard it yet, you know. It's a bit early for the applause, I think. But seriously, thank you, and it is great to be here, to finally make it to Canada, which is something that I've wanted to do for many years, and it's great to be invited and have an opportunity to get here at last. And it is wonderful to be here in this great temple of books, this embodiment of belief in the ongoing value and the importance of libraries. The Fisher Library is not only a Canadian cultural beacon, it's one of the great research libraries of the world, with wonderfully rich collections covering pretty much the whole of human civilization. The justification for such great collections of documentary heritage is, I'm sure, well rehearsed in the minds of everybody here tonight. You're all friends with a capital F, and you need no convincing of the value of libraries. But my title talks about changing values, and I want to pursue that theme because we are living in a fast-changing world where ideas which we may take for granted about the role of libraries are increasingly being challenged, and whether we like it or not, are not universally shared. So I want to ask why books matter in an increasingly digital age, where their cultural value lies, both now and going forward. And to argue that I think these are important questions to debate, not just here, but also in the wider public arena, if libraries like this are to have an enduring future. Great libraries like this one, with great research collections, have always been built around a core concept of storehouses, quarries of knowledge, ideas, held in books and other documentary formats. Human endeavour of many kinds, education, research, innovation, leisure, business, has always depended to some extent on access to information, on what other people have known or said, and for many centuries books have been the containers that hold and transmit those things. Books were created to be communication devices for texts. Libraries were evolved so as to store, to organise, to make those things available, to make them accessible in large quantities. Those who founded and funded libraries, or donated material to them, have done so in the faith that they're augmenting reservoirs of knowledge for which there is no alternative. There have been other sources of information, but when looking for authoritative, cumulative, trustworthy places to find it, civilization has turned to libraries. This late 18th century print, showing history resisting time from destroying a column of books that contains events from creation to the present day, is one of several figurative fancies like this from the early modern period that recognise that crucial role that books have played in preserving the wisdom and the record of the past. If time had his way with his scythe and he destroyed the column of books, then all of that knowledge, all that wisdom, all those reservoirs of expertise and ideas from the past would be lost forever, and he needs to be resisted. But you hardly need me, I think, to flag up that the world is changing, that the onset of the digital age has brought many questions and challenges to libraries. Developments in information technology and the use of the internet have transformed not only the ways in which libraries work, but also those underlying philosophies. Increasingly, the kind of content which books have provided is available over the web, either in born digital formats or in digitized versions of printed material. After a few years of experimentation, the e-reader that really works is, I think, now with us. Amazon have sold more Kindles than they've sold copies of the Harry Potter books. It's their single best-selling product. The British Library, in its 2020 vision, reckons that in 5 years' time, 75% of all books being published will be appearing in digital versions. Most academic libraries now spend more of their acquisitions budgets on electronic resources than on printed ones, and schools and universities are relying less and less on textbooks in the traditional sense, and more on content being delivered electronically. Bookshops, which used to rely on academic markets, are having to diversify their business models in order to survive. And I do know this kind of from, you know, direct close to home, because my wife works for the big academic bookshop in Cambridge, which is a town back home, which is not without a serious university. And the academic book market there is drying up so much that I know that the managers of that shop are thinking seriously about ceasing to sell academic texts, because, you know, they just aren't selling academic monographs. They need to diversify into selling more popular books or selling satchels or selling other kinds of merchandise if they're going to survive. The statistics, the factoids, they just tumble out of websites and other places wherever you look. And while the front line of new publications marches ever more digital, similar swathes are being cut through our vast reservoirs of printed and documentary heritage. Google made the headlines now over 10 years ago with its announcement that it would be digitizing the contents of a number of major research libraries. And since then, the progress of Google Books, I think, has been a bit like a steamroller gradually coming up behind the world of print. having to break a few rocks along the way created by copyright legislation, but kind of getting there. Google do now openly state that their mission is to organise the world's information, to make it universally accessible, to become the gateway to the world's knowledge, to the world's ideas. Now, we can all speculate with interest as to whether they, Google, will achieve stable global domination, whether the battle of the tyrannosaurs at the top of the world's digital industries, combined with a bit of antitrust legislation and popular feeling, will see Google's star wane. Perhaps, if it does, I suspect that another tyrannosaur will come up close behind. So whichever way, I think that huge critical mass of digitized content is going to grow and is going to be increasingly relied upon as retrospective digitization projects are burgeoning the world over. There's no shortage of them over here. If you want to read a Shakespeare play, a government report, a novel by Robertson Davis, or even the Toronto Globe for 1865, which is what's on the screen right now, it is no longer essential to get hold of a physical book or a printed original or to visit a library. You can do it from a handheld electronic device connected to the internet from pretty much anywhere in the world. So an axe has been laid at the root of that traditional philosophy around research libraries, and there is much debate, whether we like it or not, about their future trajectory. Increasingly, that debate takes place via the medium of the internet. There is no shortage of pages and postings commenting on the decline of physical libraries, sometimes saying, this is lamentable, it's scandalous, it's the end of the world as we know it, sometimes saying, bring it on, not a moment too soon. I think the landscape is complicated by the hybrid, the transitional nature of the world that we're living in. Partly because we're not yet at a point where everything that we might want to access is available digitally, although I think we can see what such a world would look like and that such a world is actually technically possible, and partly because we have a series of generation gaps. Those who were brought up with books, and I think that includes everybody in this room tonight, we'll probably always instinctively regard print as the primary medium and electronic as secondary. But somebody who learns to read on a Kindle or an iPad, if that's their earliest experience of books and texts and reading and stories and ideas, and then goes on from there, will think the other way around. And that generation may not be very far away. Because we're increasingly seeing things which encourage us to think of the book not as a physical object, but as an electronic one. Our London evening newspaper, the Evening Standard, has been running a campaign to get children reading. And not long ago, they printed a photograph of Stephen Fry visiting a school and getting them all fired up about books and reading. What was so noticeable was that in all the photos, they were all using tablets. There isn't a physical printed book to be seen anywhere, including Stephen Fry. When I put Children Reading Canada into Google, this was one of the first images that came up. Try it. Trust me. You know, Children Reading Canada as an image search into Google. The idea that book means something in a codex format rather than a text which you access via an electronic device is gradually shifting. So going back to my 18th century image and Time's scythe, you can forget the column of books. History is going to be standing in front of a computer screen before long. Unless, of course, there is more to books than that, which is the key point of my talk today. The word book is often used as a synonym for textual content, and I think in many people's minds, the two are one and the same. But in fact, of course, there is a lot more to physical books than the words on their pages. Books are material objects which have been designed, interacted with, individualized in all kinds of ways. A book has a shape, a page layout, a type font, perhaps pictures, all of which may subtly influence the way the reader responds to it. The medium is part of the message. It can be written in, mutilated, altered, bound, adapted in various ways, which all reflect the ways that it's been owned, read, regarded. And all the physical evidence that's associated with all of those things has cultural and research value, which may be as valuable as the printed text. It's one thing to know that a book was printed, it's another altogether to know that it was read. A book that's been annotated by an owner or a reader, put comments or questions in the margins, mark the passages that are particularly interesting, gives us a direct window into that interface between the author and his reader, as well as proving, of course, that the audience was actually there. This is Inigo Jones, the early 17th century designer of Covent Garden and the Banqueting House in Whitehall, the first significant British architect of the early modern period, according to Wikipedia, so it must be true. And this is him reading and annotating his copy of the Trattato dell'Arte of Giovanni Lomazzo. Lomazzo was a late 16th century Italian mannerist painter who went blind and took to writing about art when he could no longer practice it. And his book is now recognised as a milestone in the development of artistic theory. Here we see proof of Jones's absorption of that book, translating passages from Italian to English, underlining what seemed to him to be the important bits. According to the latest Oxford University Press edition of Elizabeth Barrett Browning's Aurora Leigh, it's the foremost example of the mid-19th century poem of contemporary life, and a richly detailed representation of the early Victorian age. That clearly was not the view of Thomas Carlyle, that great Victorian man of letters, founder of the London Library. He liberally annotated his copy of Aurora Leigh with candid and rather less complimentary thoughts. How much better if all of this had been written straightforward in clear prose? A very beautiful tempest in a teapot. What a gift of utterance this high child has, and how very weak and childlike all it has to say. Examples like this of annotations in books giving us insights into contemporary perceptions can be extended almost endlessly, as there are countless examples of them out there on library shelves, many wonderful examples here. This copy of a 16th century edition of Boccaccio's Decameron is made special by the copious interlinear marginal annotations of the Elizabethan MP and country landowner Sir Thomas Lucy, a man quite famous in the annals of Shakespeareana as he reputedly chased Shakespeare off his land and then was satirised by Shakespeare in one of the plays. And here he is translating, defining, summarising Boccaccio's text. And of course, the star of your recent Vesalius exhibition here was the copy of the 1555 edition of De Humani Corporis Fabrica, the great Renaissance atlas of human anatomy, annotated not by an owner, but by the author himself, with stylistic improvements, updated knowledge. People annotate their books in various ways. They may write notes on the flyleaves, in the margins. If they're really serious, they have them interleaved with blank paper so that they've got plenty of space to write in. And this is another example from the Fisher Stacks of an interleaved early book that's been extensively annotated on the blank pages by an early owner. They may write things that relate to the text. They may write things that seem to have nothing to do with it, that reflect their preoccupations, their boredom at the time, the availability of a piece of blank paper and a pen to do something with it. One regularly encountered type of annotation that's kind of somewhere in between is the common practice of using the blank pages in Bibles to record family events, births, marriages, deaths. For many poorer people, a Bible would be one of the few books that they owned, one safe place to record these significant events in their lives, and also, of course, an appropriate, a sacred place, the physical manifestation of the word of the Lord, in which to record these things which are so personally important. People also sometimes draw, paint in books. Here we have a copy of Montaigne's Essays, liberally embellished by a Dutch 17th century lawyer, and an English book on heraldry, which a late 18th century owner annotated extensively, including on one of the end leaves an unexpected watercolour that memorialises the departed from this life. Of course, many people don't annotate their books at all. The idea of writing in a book has always been anathema to some people. When I do straw polls at these kinds of events, you know, how many people mark their books, write in their books, put their ownership inscription in their books? It's kind of usually about 50-50. Who here marks their books in some way? Hands. Yeah, kind of 50-50, or sort of slightly less than 50-50. Those of you who didn't put your hand in the air, think about posterity and the opportunity, you know, seriously. But as I say, opinion has always been divided. Charles Lamb, another Victorian man of letters, always used to say that a genuine lover of reading liked to see the sullied leaves and the worn-out appearance of a well-used book, whereas Virginia Woolf apparently thought that writing in book was akin to a sexual violation. Collectors used to think that annotations in books, including ownership inscriptions, were defacements which detracted from their value, which is why there was a vogue, particularly in the 19th and early 20th centuries, for taking books apart and washing out those offending ink inscriptions, something which today we regard with regret, if not downright horror. Today, I think people typically regard an annotated book as more interesting than one with untouched, spotless pages. But it does, of course, create a bit of a paradox for librarians, who may see a 300-year-old book which has been scribbled in by a student of that time as something of historical interest, whereas they will regard with dismay and horror, if not anger, a modern one to which a student of today takes the biro and the highlighter. I think the dilemma was neatly summarised by this cartoon in the Times Higher Education supplement back home a few years ago. I can only say that we have to draw some lines between what you do in your own books and those which are intended for shared use. However, I will bet that the undergraduate textbooks which, say, Pierre Trudeau or Margaret Atwood covered with student scribbles or highlighting, if such things exist, will command a premium amongst both researchers and collectors in years to come. But it's important to add that annotators don't have to be famous or recognisable people in order to be interesting or to have something worth noting. Interest in the provenance of books has in the past often focused around a kind of bibliographical celebrity culture, association copies owned by kings or rock stars or their equivalents, and it is a key part of my message that we should move away from that kind of thinking and appreciate that all previous ownership in books is part of the historical fabric which is worth investigating. I think there is plenty of vernacular social history to be found in this late 18th century book of devotional verses, in which a contemporary and completely ordinary owner called Elizabeth Overton used the leaves at the end to record her feelings about marriage, headed The Virgin's Prayer. If I am doomed the marriage chains to wear, kind heaven propitious, hear my virgin's prayer. May his good sense improve my best of thoughts, and his good nature smile at all my faults, and so on for quite a while. We can observe first-hand evidence of the development of the Reformation in England, not only from Henry VIII's annotated copies of books, theological texts relating to divorce, which you can see in the British Library today, but also from the small English religious tract of the 1540s, on whose flyleaf is written, "I bought this book when the Testament was abrogated, that shepherds might not read it. I pray God amend such blindness. Writ by Robert Williams, keeping sheep upon Saintbury Hill." People may, of course, take things away from books as well as adding things to them, and I mentioned mutilation earlier as one of the ways in which books may be individualised and thereby become unique objects. Another way of seeing the Reformation at work is to look at church service books, which were in use in England during the middle of the 16th century, when the results of Henry VIII's decree that all references to the Pope or Thomas a Becket must be expunged can usually be seen in crossings out or cuttings away of parts of the text. But there's a much more recent example that I can quote of the interest that can be associated with book mutilation in the books in Islington Public Library in North London, which were subjected to the attentions of Joe Orton and Kenneth Halliwell around 1960. Supposedly fed up with the dreariness of the stock in Islington Public Library, they smuggled books out and they altered them in various ways to spice them up a bit. The librarians were duly shocked, and after a careful forensic investigation involving trapping them with a typewriter, they were caught and they were banged to rights with 6 months in jail. The severity of the sentence, particularly in view of the rather trivial and puerile nature of the amendments which they actually made, the severity of the sentence is quite striking, is thought to be not unconnected with their sexual preferences. The jail term is thought to have been a transformative experience for Orton in terms of developing his writing persona as a playwright. The rest is history. But these books are now physical manifestations and testaments to the cultural history of their time. And the great irony of this tale is that the books are now valued as special collections in Islington. They were given an exhibition a few years ago in the very library where disgust and alarm was originally expressed. I also mentioned binding as one of the ways in which books become individual and unique. And here again, we have not only endless variety, but also a lot of evidence about choices having been exercised, which may tell us something about how books have been valued and regarded. We're used to books being published with uniform bindings, so every copy of the same book looks the same when it comes out of the publisher's workshop. But that's something which has only been with us since mechanisation took over around the middle of the 19th century. Even so, we're used to the idea that a binding can tell us something about a book before you ever open it, before you ever look at the text. The binding can give you some hint of what to expect. You know from a glance, without looking inside, that the book on the left here is a serious scholarly monograph, and the other one is one to take on the beach or on the plane. You don't have to open the book. The binding tells you something about it. But before modern production methods came in, every book was individually bound by hand. The entire industry was a handcrafted process. This is a picture of a typical 18th century bindery. And no two bindings of that time can ever be truly identical, even if they look very similar as regards the ways that they've been decorated. Bindings were always produced in a range of qualities and styles, whether we're talking about the 15th century or the 18th. You could always opt to have a sixpenny binding or a 10-shilling binding or a £2 binding, depending on the taste and the depth of your pocket. These two books were both bound in London around 1670, but a lot more money was spent on the one on the right than the one on the left. These six books were all bound in England around the end of the 18th century. And again, I hope you can see that there's a progression as you move along the pictures, from the plain to the fancy, from the cheap and the cheerful to the expensive and the luxurious. So as I say, there's not just variety here, but also choices being exercised, which may tell us something from the binding about how the books were valued. To take Shakespeare as a simple example, the kinds of bindings you find on the first folio demonstrate the changing values associated with Shakespeare over time. The first folio, the first collected edition of his works, was published in 1623. There are about 230 copies surviving in the world today, and of those, only a handful, about 7% of the whole, retain more or less contemporary 17th century bindings. Those that do are all in plain, unsophisticated, sparingly decorated covers, because nobody at that time was likely to waste money on binding up plays, which came pretty low down the pecking order of works considered to be of lasting value. You're far more likely to find a theological text of that time in a fancy binding than a literary text. The one on the screen here is the copy of the first folio that was given to the Bodleian Library in Oxford around 1623, and is in a contemporary Oxford binding. Of course, the Bodleian valued it so much that when the third edition came along in the 1660s, they discarded this. I mean, why would you want a first edition when, you know, the third edition comes along to supersede it? And of course, they then had to buy it back at what was then huge expense at the beginning of the 20th century to beat off the Folger. But that's another story. But as I said, only very few first folios surviving in the world today retain contemporary bindings looking like this. The great majority were taken out of their simple calfskin bindings in the 19th and 20th century when wealthy collectors were acquiring them and thinking that the bard needed to be more suitably clothed. This is a picture of some of the 80 or so folios in the vault at the Folger Shakespeare Library, where most of them are in gilded goatskin by high-end 19th century binders, or a bit later, reflecting those changing values associated with the text of Shakespeare over time. And if you're interested in this line of thought about what bindings can tell us, you might enjoy the chapter about bindings in Christian Jensen's book on the fashions in collecting incunabula, 15th century printed books, in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, when again, old books were taken out of their clumsy old bindings to be recovered in new and expensive ways, in keeping with the owner's perception of these books as trophies to display their discernment, to display their taste, to display their social status. It's very much the book as a material object whose meaning resides as much in its physical characteristics as it does in its text. Bindings can, of course, tell us all kinds of other things, like where the book was bound, and therefore where it was owned and where it was read, because the tools that are used for decorating them can often be documented and recognised. So we can tell that the book on the left here, from the decoration on its covers, that it was bound in Cambridge around 1630, The book on the right was bound in Cambridge about a century later because the tools used to decorate it are identifiable. People started marking their ownership of books by having their names, their initials, their coats of arms tooled onto the bindings from the middle of the 16th century onwards. So there are lots of books out there with this kind of evidence to tell us where they've been. Here in Toronto, you host the database of British armorial book bindings, an online directory edited by your good friend and mine, Philip Oldfield, who's in the room somewhere. Since its launch a couple of years ago, this has become established as a hugely useful standard reference source in this area, which by its very existence helps to raise awareness of the value of these kinds of bindings. But the mere fact of ownership of a book, however bound, whether annotated or not, is also potentially valuable evidence of previous interest in it, and the collections that people and libraries form in toto helps us to see patterns of changing values around what is or is not worth having. Reconstructing the contents of private and institutional libraries allows us to compare them with other collections of their time, build up wider pictures of book ownership over the generations, look at average sizes, changing trends in language, in subject, in place of origin. We can see which books were popular and which were not. Books have survived in very uneven ways, and ones which are rare today may once have been much more widely read than ones which have survived in greater quantities. It's easy to forget that values change, that books that we think of today as the milestones of their age may in their own time have been seen differently and differently perceived. taking Shakespeare again, literature more generally, I think most people today would take it for granted that literature is more interesting than theology, and if you look at the prices that a first folio commands in the marketplace today, well, you can get a lot of 17th century theology for one first folio. But 17th century libraries were typically comprised of at least 50% theology, as we would now define it, and literature, as we think of it today, had much less of a look-in. I did some work a few years ago on some late 17th century private library collections, comparing in detail which books regularly appeared in everybody's shelves and which didn't. And the results were that the things which everybody owned were primarily theology, Greek and Roman classical texts. Books which nobody wanted to be without were things like the works of St. Augustine, Richard Hooker's treatise on the laws of ecclesiastical polity. None of the libraries that I looked at had any copies of Shakespeare at all. Literature, as we would define it, was most popularly represented by John Barclay's Argenis, a book-length romance, which was also an allegory of 17th century European politics, which was much read in the 17th century, but today is hardly read at all, and I think most of us would find it pretty hard going. Literary figures who we would recognise, who got a look in those 17th century libraries, were Milton and Donne, but the former was owned at least as much for his political writings as he was for Paradise Lost, and Donne featured as much for his sermons as for his poems. So ownership evidence in books, as expressed in inscriptions, in bookplates, in ink stamps, whatever, is therefore valuable in helping to build up those patterns of knowledge. So I've been talking about a range of ways in which copy-specific post-production evidence in books, aspects of their physical characteristics as three-dimensional objects, helps us to understand the ways that they've been used. Their cultural value can derive at least as much from these aspects as from their textual content. And I would say, don't just take my word for it, look at the ways in which book history as a discipline has developed in recent years, with an emphasis on understanding not so much what books were produced, as in what was their social impact. And this kind of evidence is essential if we're going to elucidate that. So studies on the reading, the use of books, on marginalia, on annotations, on book ownership, on private libraries, all of these things have been flourishing in recent years. New books, websites appear all the time. Within the last few years, we've seen the launch of pan-national public databases like ProBoc, which charts copy-specific evidence in books in Scandinavian libraries, material evidence in incunabula, annotated books online. Academic centres are springing up in universities with names like the Centre for the Study of Material Texts, trying to embrace that concept that the study of books should be looking at them as objects in their totality. The copy census as a methodology is gaining ground, looking at the evidence in multiple copies of the same book, not to ascertain printing variants, but to see how the ownership, the annotations, the binding, what those things can tell us about the book's impact individually and collectively. The best known of these is probably Owen Gingerich's study on Copernicus. He went around the world and he examined about 600 surviving copies of the first two editions of De Revolutionibus, the book in which Copernicus put forward his theory that the Earth went round the sun and not the other way around. And his findings revealed not only a communication network amongst 16th century scientific investigators across Europe, but also that the thing which seemed most to interest Copernicus's contemporaries was not actually the heliocentric theory, but Copernicus's maths. But there have been several other censuses like this published in recent years, looking at literary authors, classical authors, and I think as a way of approaching book historical questions, it has much merit. If you think this all sounds a bit academic, consider also that there is now a website for crowdsourcing information about marginalia found in modern public library books, and there is a marginalia group on Facebook, which has over 3,000 members. What does this all mean for libraries and their users? I think it means a change in emphasis, gradually manifested across a range of practices and values. In presenting to the world what's interesting or special about their holdings, we will see more exhibitions that focus not so much on authors or subjects or famous texts, but more on the ways that the books have been owned and used and what this can tell us. And these are a few examples from Scotland, from America, and one from here in Canada. There is an exhibition like this on in New York right now. It means new emphases in collecting policy, discarding perhaps traditional interest in textual holdings. If everything, or at least everything that you want, is available digitally on sustainable platforms in which users can have confidence, what is the rationale for ongoing collection development of the traditional kind? Better maybe to focus on those copy-specific aspects of books where they can offer unique research value. Some years ago, Yale University bought a collection of books whose unifying theme was that the books were all heavily annotated, and I think we'll see more of that kind of collection building in the future. If you have a choice to make here between buying a 19th century book on a Canadian subject, which isn't in the Fisher, but is held in other libraries and is readily available in online facsimile, or a book of the same period whose text has no direct Canadian connection, but which was used in a Toronto school and is annotated by a local schoolboy, which is the better book to acquire? Well, we know the Fisher would acquire both, but, you know, supposing you were hard up, which is the better one? I'll leave you to think about that. We need to adjust our cataloguing policies to take cognizance of these changes of emphasis, pay more attention to the copy-specific features of books. The cataloguing and arrangement of books in libraries has traditionally assumed that users would only be interested in authors, in titles, in subjects. Scantier attention has been paid to owners, to annotations, to bindings, to other copy-specific aspects. That is changing, and many cataloguers today do include searchable information about such things in their records, but there is an awful lot of catching up to do. As a general rule, the larger the library, the greater the backlog and the quantity of material that's not accessible from that angle. I have to say that the Fisher catalogue entry for the Boccaccio that I showed earlier, annotated by Thomas Lucy, does have a note in the catalogue record that it's autographed by him, and it has his notes, but there is no added entry for Lucy. If you search the catalogue using Lucy's name, you won't find this book. And, you know, that, I'm not having a go at the Fisher, you know, it's the legacy of the cataloguing systems that have come down to us, and countless libraries are in the same position. The same principles apply to preserving evidence in library books, including historic bindings, which at first glance may look quite ordinary, but have been destroyed in their thousands by well-meaning librarians of the past who've assumed that the only thing anyone would ever want to do with a book is turn its pages and read its words. More philosophically, and also I think more controversially, it's a train of thought that points perhaps to a different set of values around libraries and what they are, or about where the key importance of their collections might lie. It suggests a closer alignment between libraries and museums, where hitherto there's been a fundamental difference. Libraries, like museums, both contain manufactured items from the past, which help us to understand and discover that past. But in libraries, the assumption has always been that the primary purpose of the objects is to carry on doing them, using them in the way that their makers intended. You go into a library to read a book, but you don't go into a museum to sit on a 19th century chair or to use an 18th century silver spoon to stir your coffee. Maybe in the future there'll be a little more coming together of those missions. I say it's controversial because in my experience, librarians do tend to bristle a bit at the M word. You know, museum's a bit of a dirty word to librarians. It, you know, sort of sounds like dust and anachronism. But let's not forget that many museums have had a huge renaissance in recent times, have reinvented themselves through outreach and dynamic public engagement programs. So maybe it's not quite so threatening. At the end of the day, I do think that these issues, the ideas that I've been talking about, are important and need to be widely promulgated and discussed, because otherwise, I think we are in danger of losing things that matter. Libraries are expensive things to run. Miles of shelf space costs money. And the march of digitization presents opportunities to do a lot of shelf clearing. Presented with graphs like this, which I got from an internet search on trends in library usage, people, politicians, administrators are going to ask questions. I am not advocating that libraries shouldn't throw books away, because that has always been an aspect of library management. Nor do I think it's terrible that they are busily reinventing themselves in the 21st century, because digital surrogacy and born digital media are here to stay. I personally think that a lot of baloney is talked about dumbing down, about turning libraries into Starbucks, about the impossibility of serendipitous browsing in an online environment, as though nobody has discovered the power of Google. What does concern me is the rationale that underpins the discarding, because it tends to be based only on textual surrogacy. If you follow these arguments about changing values, about what are going to be the unique values of books and collections, then I hope you'll see that a more museum-like approach calls for an adjusted set of criteria being applied to the way those collections are managed. You may say I protest too much. Obviously, nobody is going to discard material of unique or historic importance, though you may remember that North American libraries were taken to task a few years ago for discarding 19th century newspapers that had been microfilmed. I didn't have to look very far on Google to find evidence that Canadian libraries are facing the kinds of challenges and bad news stories that you will find the world over, and certainly back in the UK. You may also say that the kinds of things I've been talking about, evidence of use, annotation in books that makes them interesting, will only apply to older material that's already safe in special collections. And to answer that by illustration and example, I was giving a talk a bit like this a few years ago in London to a group of librarians about provenance. And one of them came up to me at the end and said, I work for the Royal Society of Medicine, and I recently accessioned a contemporary book which had belonged to a distinguished living haematologist. And it had his pencil notes on the flyleaf commenting on a recently introduced drug, saying how ineffective it was, how it shouldn't be used, how, you know, it's all a bad idea. Of course, he said, I had to rub those out before I put the book on the shelf, as it wouldn't be appropriate for anybody to see them. To which I said, you did what? That was probably the only part of that book which had long-term research value. The text probably exists in an online form already. If it doesn't, it very soon will. The one thing about it that was unique were those notes on the flyleaf by the contemporary haematologist commenting on some aspect of contemporary medicine. We understand why he did it, but it's a classic case of applying a set of values to the management of library collections that's actually wrong-headed. It reminds us of the mid-20th century librarian at Dr. Williams Library in London, where they have a number of books that belong to the 19th century novelist George Eliot, who took a rubber to George Eliot's penciled marginalia in the books, because, of course, nobody likes books that have been written in. Why does it matter? Because history matters. There are acres of academic discussions and books out there about the value and the use of history, but beyond all of that, I think there is a more fundamental and visceral point that I'm sure many of us will understand, that history helps us to understand where we've come from, it gives people roots, it's why it's so popular. People want history, as is testified by the global success of genealogical websites, historical programs in the media. Libraries are reservoirs of historical evidence that should be appreciated and exploited as such. What we need to do, though, is recognise that the areas where the key value lies may be changing. We should give more attention to books as material objects rather than just words on pages. And that debate and that message needs to be got out to the public at large. The politicians they vote into office who decide the library budget, it's nobody just talking to the converted who may be us in this room. They're the ones who need to understand. We all need to go out and evangelise and help spread that broader understanding of why books have value. If we don't, there's a threat that a different kind of approach to books as objects may take hold. There is a growing number of books appearing on the market, like The Repurposed Library, 33 craft projects that give old books new life, all about taking orphaned and outdated books, turning them into sculptures, decorations, other useful household objects, a hanging mirror, a lampshade, narrative verses. And here at the University of Toronto, in the Fisher Library, I was down in the stacks earlier today, and they have a whole load of Christmas decorations made out of discarded book catalogues. You know, there's a lot of it about. A lot of this, you know. There is going to be a lot more discarding of books going on in the wake of the march of digitization. There is going to be a growing questioning of the necessity for ongoing investment in big physical libraries. And if we don't generate a broad recognition of those different kinds of cultural values and unique qualities that can be found amongst our books and collections, well, maybe the wrong kinds of books will get turned into lampshades or even Christmas decorations. I wrote more about these ideas and the things that I've been talking about tonight in that book of mine called Books as History, which Anne kindly mentioned at the beginning, which is deliberately pitched as a colourful and hopefully accessible setting out of these issues, not a scholarly monograph, because, as I say, I think it's a broad audience that needs to be engaged with those ideas. If you'd like to explore further, well, available from all good bookshops, as they say. And on that shameful plug, I rest my case. Thank you very much.